Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Hello, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year to all the Brokenomics viewers. Now, have you ever watched TV and the series will be quite good, and even a really good series will do this, and at some point you're just given a filler episode, an episode that serves no purpose apart from to save time and effort for the writers. So I'm thinking of an episode like The Fly in Breaking Bad, which is, you know, the only new bit of content they recorded that is Walter White chasing a fly down in his lab thing. But then they did loads and loads of flashbacks to previous things that happened. It was just pure filler. And I also saw this in me and the woman rewatched Stargate and Stargate Atlantis recently. And like every season, they do that. They record a minimal amount of content and then they just do a whole load of flashbacks. And it's really annoying and it's really lazy. And I've always hated it. And I thought, if ever I have a creative endeavor, I am not going to do that shit. Well, anyway, I'm now doing that shit. And the reason is because I am off for Christmas and the studio's closed and I was busy and I didn't have time to record an extra thing. So I'm just doing filler crap. And but I'm going to try and make it good for you by highlighting the very best stuff that I have done over the course of the last year and maybe a little bit beyond it as well to find the really best stuff. And so we're going to play some clips of the absolute highlights of Brokenomics. We're going to make it freemium so that all of you can watch it, because when I go through these, I'll tell you the view count, but they're the view count of like the master race, the people who are actually Lotus Eater subscribers. Every so often, I get people come up to me in the streets and say, oh, you're Dan, aren't you? And I love Brokenomics and stuff like that. And then I'm like thinking, oh, this is good. So I'm like shaking their hand and patting them on the back and then saying, how long have you been a subscriber? And they say, oh, no, I'm not a subscriber. I just watch it on YouTube. And then I'm thinking, oh, you bastard. It's only £5 a month, right? That is clearly less than you spend on stuff that will make you fat that you don't need, just mouth pleasure that you have. I mean, not that kind. That you have. You could just buy one less bloody coffee or milkshake or something and subscribe, and then we can pay editors, right? It's important. But anyway, some of you don't subscribe. Maybe if I give you a bit of talking to, you might find the Christmas cheer in you just to bloody subscribe on lotuseaters.com. It's literally only £5 a month. You will not be, even if you're proper poor, you can afford that. Anyway, right. So, let's get on with, the episodes, that we did. All of this is going to be possible thanks to my main man, Thomas, the editor. He's really my co-partner in creating Brokenomics. He does lots of good stuff, and he's put this all together. And so what I've got here is a list of things that you, the audience, really liked, and then I've tagged a few on my own personal favourites as well. And we talk about what was particularly great. Thomas did the one that you should have seen perhaps last week, the one where I was having a conversation with Santa. So he's bloody brilliant. I should give him this is his Christmas bonus, me giving him some praise. And I went to him and said, I want to have an argument with myself. Can you make it happen? He was like, yes, I can make that happen. So solid stuff. You'll see his name often gets attached to the top of episodes. So give him, but don't poach him. If you need an editor, no, he's no good for that. Leave him alone. I want him here. Right. Anyway. First episode that apparently you people quite liked was Brokenomics, Economics with Crayons for Socialists. Interesting, but that is one of the... That got 5,000 plus views. It's really interesting to me that episode did so well. And the reason that it did so well is because that was probably my lowest effort video of the entire year. Basically, I'd been busy with... a whole bunch of other content and some other business stuff that we're doing here in Lotus Eaters. And basically that week I was just run ragged. And I thought, what is the lowest effort that I can put into a Brokenomics? And I thought, I know, I'll just get a glossary of basic economic terms and I'll just sit there and explain them, like really simplistically, as if I'm talking to a socialist. And you guys absolutely bloody loved it. And this is a weird thing, right, with content creators. They often notice the more effort you put into something, the less the audience likes it. And the lower effort you put in, the more they like it. But anyway, it's a bit weird. Watch this and then I'll meet you on the other side. Next basic idea I want to explain, the Laffer curve. The basics of the Laffer curve is that there's a peak point in taxation. So a very basic Laffer chart. Actually, crayons would have been great for this. Imagine a chart that has tax rate along the bottom, 0% to 100%. And imagine on the top part of the graph, it is amount of tax collected. And the Laffer curve is basically, it goes up and then down again. Reason. If your tax rate is 0%, then you will get zero tax revenues. Obviously, because you're not taxing anything. But if you tax 100%, then you will also get zero. And the reason is that if you are going to be taxed 100%, you know, everything that you do is immediately taken off you, why would you bother doing anything at all? You wouldn't. You just wouldn't work. There's no, literally no point in working at all. And when the Laffer curve is shown in books, it's often this smooth hump, which might lead you to assume that the maximum point on the chart is 50%. That's often how it's shown in books. In practice, and we don't know what it is, because we don't yet have enough real-world examples. It would be great if we could set up, you know, a second Earth and try, you know, taxing everyone half as much on that and see what happened. I think the productive output would soar on that second Earth. Maybe in time with enough computation and AI, we'd better run models on this kind of stuff. But I suspect that the revenue maximizing point on that curve, i.e. the one that raises the most amount of tax, is probably a tax rate in somewhere around the 15% mark. Right, anyway, hope you like that one. What have we got next? We've got Brokenomics debate. Sex, feminism, and the death of civilization with almost 6,000 views on that one. And that's proper views, not YouTube views. If you add YouTube views, it goes well beyond that. And this is the Dutton, Sula Kowalski, Rayner debate. So that is when... So I had Dr. Sula Kowalski on. She was absolutely brilliant. And she reframed feminism for me, and when I heard the reframe, I just immediately got it. And what she was saying is that feminism is an evolutionary strategy developed by women to try and prevent other women from having children, because if you can prevent other women from having children, that means that you raise the prospects of your own offspring by virtue of the fact they're competing with fewer other offspring. So the successful feminist is one who lives a traditional life and has children, but convinces other women to basically stay working in a cubicle, get in debt, hate men, don't have children. And it works, and apparently it works for women, but it doesn't work for men, because for men there's literally no point trying to stop other men from having men, because if you miss one, he'll just go around and have all the children. Whereas women, because fertility comes in such longer chunks, you know, 9 months as opposed to, I don't know, 45 minutes, maybe a bit less, maybe 10 minutes, there is literally no point in trying to gatekeep men in this way. So that's why it is a female that's why feminism is a female sabotage strategy. Anyway, so she explained it brilliantly. And then after that, loads of people in the comments were like, oh, you should get into debate with Ed Dutton. So I did. And his co-author. So anyway, loads of you really like this debate, but I think both of them side by side are excellent. You should check them out. Anyway, let's watch the highlights from that one.
Well, I think you're right that it is cyclical. That's sure. But then the best explanation is that which explains the most. And I think that just to say, oh well, it's a sexual competition mechanism. I mean, first of all, one of the things you said, I wrote it down earlier. You talked about the reproduction game changing and nobody's children dying off or something to that effect, or
The
less
child
child will have.
mortality goes down, yeah.
But
And surely
that's not, I'm not
after
sure that's quite right, because what you see under conditions of harsh Darwinian selection, for example, if you look at the research by Gregory Clark and The Sun Also Rises, what's been shown in that and other research is that there was substantial differential completed fertility among different social classes.
farewell
So,
to arms.
yeah, farewell to arms. So the richer 50% of the society had about double the completed fertility of the poorer 50%. And
Right.
people knew this. People were aware of this. I forget which doc it was. Some book I've cited somewhere that was written in about 1670 about demographics. People were aware of this, that the children of the poor died off, and they didn't reproduce. And so, it's a phrase that Ollie has coined. In a sense, our society was being self-genocided by its upper class every generation. And the genes of the higher classes, the genes therefore of the more intelligent, were moving their way down every generation, which is why all of we English people are descended from Edward the Third, because that process was occurring. So I think the most parsimonious explanation has to bring into its purview the genetic explanations, which we have, oh, sorry, the genetic changes, which are congruous with the behavioral changes that we note in wokeness, which would predict that happening, and other changes. It has to explain the lot.
Well, I
And
think.
your explanation is only explaining an element of it. I think your explanation can be
Wait, wait, wait.
taken
Hang on.
and be brought under the purview of a larger explanation.
Which aspects of wokeness are you suggesting that I'm not explaining? Because your explanation then, you sort of pointed out how it was always the case that the wealthiest were having the most completed reproduction, right? And so the less wealthy were not. And so what began happening when societies began getting wealthier? That began to change, right? Once you're in a society where it is typically, right, so this is my argument. Once you are in a society where the differential wealth of the wealthiest is no longer sufficient to guarantee differential reproductive success, the women begin to change their behavior such that they maintain that differential reproductive success. And the way they change their behavior is to engage in manipulative reproductive suppression of the women below them, because they can't rely on the lack of wealth and the poverty of those women to kill those women's babies for them. And so what we see now that we are currently calling woke is just the current manifestation of this female manipulative reproductive suppression by the wealthy women whose wealth is no longer affording them the differential reproductive success that it used to, which is why this stuff emerges when societies get sufficiently wealthy that the poorest 50% are no longer just having babies that die all the time. When you're not
But
getting that
surely,
pressure.
surely the in a context of harsh Darwinian selection and high child mortality, if you're a wealthy woman, there is every possibility that your offspring will die off or whatever, and so there would be a very strong pressure to be very competitive.
Okay, and the next up is Brokenomics Conspiracies. Over 6,000 views on that one. Again, proper views, not YouTube views. Well beyond that on YouTube, of course. With Bo. Now, this is an interesting episode. This is something that I'd wanted to do for a long time. I like talking about this stuff. But I thought, well, I can't really get away with it, can I? Because Brokenomics is not really supposed to be that. So, but eventually I just couldn't contain myself anymore. And so I think on the previous episodes, I casually mentioned that, oh, maybe I should do a conspiracy episodes with Bo and, tell me in the comments if you like that. And everybody was like, yes, do that. So that gave me the permission to do what I actually really wanted to do anyway, which was talk about conspiracies with Bo. And glad I did. God knows what it's got to do with Brokenomics. But it was a fun episode, and you all liked it because it was really popular. So let's check out a bit of that.
Flat Earth comes out of, not entirely, but often it's sort of, it can be an early Christian thing.
Oh, that's definitely what's going on here.
And the dinosaurs, often it's a creationist thing.
Yeah, because if you read
the
Bible,
don't want to accept that the Earth is in fact billions of years old.
Because they go like 9,000 years or something, don't they?
Some, yeah.
So therefore, yeah. There can't be dinosaurs. Mm. So I can imagine if you're a Christian, you have to get to this position.
It's not all Christians. It's a particular type of creationist, isn't it? It's not all Christians by at all.
Yes.
You get geologists that are Christians. There's no problem. It's just a particular type of creationism.
Yes.
I forget what they're called now, but yeah. People that won't accept Darwin and the theory of evolution. It's all wrapped up in that dinosaurs aren't real, or that the geological record is not what you've been led to believe it is. Yeah. And once again, I put it in the same category as flat earth, is that you're just not accepting reality. You're failing to reason properly.
Yes.
Geology is real.
So
the earth is billions of years old. And if you go down to certain strata, it must be millions of years ago. And there you will find fossilized remains of megafauna and flora. So it's just a complete nonsense and cope that dinosaurs aren't real.
Yes.
For me.
I agree with you on that one.
It's just
ongoing debates. Clinton body count. That's not so much of a conspiracy. I mean, I think that Clintons have been killing people. What do you think?
Well, again, it's a matter of record that loads and loads of people that have been close to them, have died in suspicious circumstances, like, or committed suicide.
Statistically, like, aberrant.
Yeah, completely. Completely aberrant. I think it's fair to say that's a matter of record.
Mm.
It's not like a conspiracy theory or one person claimed it and actually people have looked into it and it's just not true. It is true.
Yes.
Your average person will know a small number of people that died, were murdered or committed suicide.
Yes.
Very small number. You might know one or two or half a dozen your whole life, maybe. If it's over 10 or 20, that's weird. If it's in the dozens and dozens and dozens, I mean, even someone that's a public figure, that's an ex-president or whatever, an ex-senator, they will know more people than a normal person like you or I. So, okay, they're okay. And all that sort of stuff. But still, the numbers are weirdly high.
Okay, hope that was good. Next up, amongst the audience favourites, is Brokenomics Geopolitical Flashpoints with Faraz Moodad. And so this was the second conversation that I had with Faraz. The first one I thought was absolutely brilliant, and that's on my list. This has replaced that one because I put his one on my list. So this one has ended up going here. So this was the second conversation. I think we've got the next one coming up again in a minute. So this was a follow-up conversation. And you can see why, after the first one, why I wanted to invite him back, and why after the second one, I had to go and have a word with Carl and was like, you've got to check this guy out. He is solid. We need to get this guy because he will really flesh out what we're offering here at the Lotus Eaters, because he can add something that, you know, Carl, Bo and I tend to dip into geopolitics, but we're kind of tourists. I mean, we can do a bit of it, but Faraz, I mean, he just has absolute expertise on this, and he is super based. Really, really. There's always this competition. Well, Bo and Harry think it's a competition, but there's this competition between, you know, me, Bo and Harry as to who's the most based Lotus Eater. And I mean, in fairness, Faraz, he just effortlessly wins. So he's a solid chap. Watch this on the follow-up, at which point it was obvious we had to have him at Lotus Eaters. If the relationship between Russia and China is strong, it's going to severely reduce one of the US's big trump cards, which is if Russia is dealing with its, you know, regional wider orbit of people, and it's doing it through US-controlled shipping lanes, the US Navy has the ability to interdict those, which always gives it that trump card in the pocket if it needs it.
Mm.
If the relationship with Russia and China continues to develop in the way it is, all of this stuff is going to be done by transcontinental rail lines, which the US Navy has no hope of interdicting.
Exactly.
And it basically solidifies that relationship.
Yes.
And I don't know how far along the path that relationship is, but I'd imagine it's full steam at the moment.
It's full steam. They're building new pipelines and expanding existing pipelines. They're building more infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, the policy from Clinton through Bush, through Obama and Biden has given China its Lebensraum. They've given it the sort of expanse and the natural resources that it needs to be a dominant power. The question is, how reversible is this? And if it isn't reversible, can the West be insulated from it?
But is it even believable? Because let's say I'm Putin and Witkoff turns up and he convinces me that there is a change of direction in the US and I believe him. I've still got to believe that at the next election or possibly the one after that, it's going to flip back the other way.
Yes.
So why the hell should I, even if I agree with Witkoff, why would I go there?
Yeah. And this is something that Putin has mentioned repeatedly, that the Americans are not deal ready and that he meets with these envoys, are not deal capable, sorry, and that he meets with these envoys and he meets with these presidents and they keep changing and they all promise one thing, go back home, and the men in gray suits sit them down and tell them what it's really like, and everything changes. And nothing that was agreed between Putin and an American president actually happens. So Putin's side of the story is that he cannot take the word of an American president. What might be different is if there is a severe enough institutional purge in the United States and there is a change in dogma in the establishment, which is a multi-year task. It's not about appointing a few cabinet secretaries here and there. That might make America deal ready. But there's an argument,
transformational change.
And there's an argument that it can only happen in the event of a massive shock that hits the American system.
Are we talking a civil war level shock or something?
Either an internal conflict or an external defeat.
Okay, and the last, I believe, are the audience favourites, although actually the rest of them were pretty highly ranked by the audience as well, is the Imperium of Dan. Well, it was supposed to be the Imperium of Dan. I told the guy who does the loading it onto the website, I said, I want this episode called the Imperium of Dan, because I thought that would be a clever pun. And he changed it to the Imperium of Man, which I suppose is more accurate. But anyway, I was annoyed by that. And what did this get? This got well over 6,000 views on this one. So this, again, is another Brokenomics episode. What the hell it's got to do with Brokenomics? I mean, I kind of smudged it in to fit with Brokenomics. But it was me and Samson, the producer guy here, who does the button stuff when we're doing the podcasts and some other bits. He's a big Warhammer fan, so we had a chat about it, and this was framed as a very high level introduction to the theme to see if people liked it so that we could have an excuse to do it again. And actually, evidently, looking at the numbers, we need to do this again. We need more content on this, so I need to have a think about how I can again shoehorn this in somehow to being about Brokenomics. But actually, the way we frame it, I mean, there are economic systems. There's a lot of economic systems going on in the Imperium. So it's all Warhammer stuff. By the way, if you don't know, it's Warhammer stuff, which is like in the future, and it's a bit grim and dark and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, yeah, watch this. Quick highlight. And if you want more of it, let me know, because I need excuses to do this kind of stuff. Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, on this episode, I am going to be fixing the Imperium of Man, which is a big project. But in order to help me, I've got Samson.
The Emperor has called for me.
Yes.
To assist him. I think you're one of the Emperor's most loyal servants at the moment.
Well, exactly. Yes. I'm going to call this episode the Imperium of Dan.
Yes.
Yes. If you know about Warhammer, you'll find that incredibly funny.
Yes.
Backwardness and chaos and barbarity, and humanity looks proper done at that point, until we get the emergence of the God Emperor, and he comes up and he says, no, enough of this, I'm going to put this place in order, and he begins conquering the entire Earth, and he's very successful. He does that, and once he's finished that, he's like, now I'm going to conquer everything else.
Yep. He starts, I believe, it's called the Great Crusade.
Yes.
Basically, unites humanity on Earth, and then begins his, well, soon to be called Holy Conquest across the stars to reunite this post-utopian society.
Because he knows there's all these other human worlds out there.
Yep.
Now, he's convinced that because the massive space perverts screwed up once before, if humanity doesn't get its shit together, something like that is going to happen again. And the only way to stop that is if humanity is united under him, and then they exterminate everything that isn't humanity. Which, you know, give him credit. Bold plan.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
It has its merits.
Yes, it has its merits. So anyway, and now in order, and we're almost done with the lore bit, and then we can get on with the actual problem with Imperium. In order to conquer the galaxy, it occurs to him that it might be useful to have an entire race of super soldiers built. So he promptly goes off and builds them. So he builds himself 20 generals, and these are basically, you know, transhuman demigods. They're like 14 foot tall, and they're
multiple hearts.
Yes.
Yeah, multiple extra organs that they keep inventing, basically, yes, to make them the most powerful soldiers the galaxy have ever seen.
Well, the Primarchs, he calls his sons. There's 20 of those. And these are absolute superhuman-type beings. I mean, they're absolutely singular, apart from him.
Yes.
Right, the next up one is the first conversation that I had with Faraz. Faraz just nailed it in this one. I didn't know what I was getting with him, but he came in and he just completely nailed it. And I mean, it's just so good. Oh, by the way, if you're not watching Real Politique, you really should, because he's got his own show now on the Lotus Eaters, and it's quite superb. And he really gets under the skin of things. And the other cool thing about Faraz is because he's Middle Eastern, he gets a pass on certain questions, so he can just go there, which is kind of necessary for covering geopolitics fairly. So do check out the work that he's been doing. But yeah, here's some clips from the first conversation we had that really cemented him as a man to listen to.
60, but yes, okay.
Okay, 56. They're 50, 60 grand, are they, these drones? Okay, a bit more expensive.
Yes.
A bit more expensive than I thought, but an aircraft carrier, I don't know how many hundreds of millions that runs into.
So let's put all of this in context. First thing, the fact that the plane fell off meant that it wasn't secured properly. And that's a training issue. Mm. In a crisis, somebody forgot to secure the plane properly.
Well, and also the fact the aircraft carrier was turning so sharply because all the previous lines of defense
Yes. So that's the second issue. But the in trainings for maneuvers, you would train on this kind of sharp turn as part of your regular work in the Navy. And you were supposed to know what to put where and how to stabilize it.
Yes.
The second part is that it penetrated all of this air defense and that the aircraft carrier did have to maneuver in the first place. Now, we don't know exactly what was penetrated and how much was penetrated and how much of it was sort of just in case or the air defense was fully penetrated. The third part is that it's been 2 or 3 months of this bombardment, and Biden obviously had been doing it for a while longer. And yet this kind of capability and anti-air capability with the Houthis still persists. So the American Navy is doing all of this fighting and they haven't been able to contain the problem. The final point is that when this war started, I said Yemen was going to be a huge problem because the nature of the terrain, the extent of weaponry that's available to the Houthi, the cost of these missiles, etc., etc. Then I saw what happened with Hezbollah, and I thought, well, okay, if the Americans can fight this way and have that kind of intelligence on Hezbollah's leadership, then they might be able to turn it around and force the Yemenis to comply. So far, we haven't seen that yet.
Okay, when you say American intelligence on Hezbollah, I mean, do you mean Israeli?
Well, it's the same thing.
Right, okay. But do the Israelis have an interest in Yemen?
Yes, because it's their shipping lanes that are being shut. It's over their shipping that this is happening. But I don't think that they have anywhere near the same collection capability against the Houthi. The question is, how much would they have collected from the Iranians that would have translated into understanding of the Houthi?
Okay.
Because the Israelis have penetrated the Iranians as well as Hezbollah, as well as Hamas, to be able to do the kinds of things that they're doing.
Right. And now some clips of episodes that don't fall neatly into the audience top five. They're some of my favourites. And actually, some of these go back to 2024. So they don't even count in the remit that I was given by my editor. But I just wanted to include them anyway. And actually, this one did extremely well. So this is Broconomics IQ. 6,000 views, very solid episode. And it was when I interviewed Ed Dutton. And Ed is brilliant, flamboyantly eccentric, and touches of genius interwoven into that as well. Quite a few touches of genius, actually. He's a very smart guy. And we had a conversation about IQ. And again, I like episodes where I thought I knew what I was talking about, and then it's like, oh, bloody hell, there's all these angles that I hadn't considered. And I end up thinking about them for quite a lot longer after having recorded them, because like, oh, yeah, that was, yeah. You know what I mean. Right, anyway, here's the episode. Well, hello. Welcome to Broconomics. I am here today with Edward Dutton.
Hello.
Evolutionary psychologist. Actually, you tell me what you are.
Yeah, I suppose I'm an evolution psychologist. Yeah.
Yes, Professor Ed Dutton, who a man who knows a thing or two about intelligence, because you know I've got this eking suspicion that on Brokenomics we are always talking about broken systems, things going wrong. Quite possibly there is a more fundamental cause to the ones that we've been discussing up till now.
The chavs, whatever you want to call them, you know, the dinos. Yes. This new word I've learned.
Yes.
They simply didn't exist in 1880.
Because they just wouldn't have made it.
We hadn't, IQ had not gone down that far. They didn't exist. And the people that are the sort of working class of today, as it were, they're working in a shop, whatever that kind of thing, they would be on the streets in the workhouse dying in 1880. They'd be right at the bottom of society.
Because society was basically harder and you needed to be sharp.
Yeah, but
to
also
make your way through.
They're just that they were right at the bottom. So they were the bottom. And now there's a new further standard deviation that's coming at the bottom. Which is the underclass, which just didn't, but those kind of people, they just didn't exist.
Okay.
That's the opposite of what we used to have. Up until about 1800, it was exactly the opposite. We were breeding for intelligence, and intelligence was going up every generation.
That is interesting. Now, another fundamental question that I have before I start to get into a little bit more depth on this stuff is, am I right in any way when I think there are different types of high intelligence? Because I'm pretty sure that I would have made a rubbish auditor because I'm rubbish at detail, but I've made a pretty good investor because I'm good at seeing broad patterns and I don't mind, in fact, I quite enjoy being contrarian. And I often meet people who are clearly high intelligent, but they just seem to be intelligent to me in a different way. So are there different types of high intelligence, or is it just how you apply yourself over your life that gets you to that point?
So, first of all, with the intelligence pyramid I mentioned earlier, there is a correlation, I don't know what it is, 0.5 or whatever, between spatial, on average, between spatial intelligence, mathematical intelligence, and linguistic intelligence. Normally, people that are good at one are good at all three. Now, and then you get this G factor that underpins it for that reason. But there are variations. So you're going to get some people that are very, very linguistically tilted, very, very high linguistic intelligence or whatever, very good poets or writers or lawyers, but they might be very poor spatial intelligence to the extent they can't drive a car. Like A.J. Ayer was an example of that. Couldn't drive a car. Or Einstein used to just get lost. You're getting other people, again, very good at maths, whatever, but the tongue-tied physicist or whatever, not very linguistically intelligent. They're unusual, that they exist. Or you might even get someone that has very high linguistic intelligence or whatever, but he's in something lower down the pyramid of intelligence, as it were. Like maybe he has very slow reaction times, very slow processing speed. So these kinds of variations exist, and that's going to affect how good you are at certain tasks. What you also get, it's called the cognitive integration effort hypothesis, is that the more intelligent you are, the weaker is the positive manifold between the different kinds of intelligence. So as you become, let's say you've got really high IQ, 145, really, really high IQ, then you might be absolutely rubbish at some of the things that are at the base of the pyramid that I mentioned earlier, the cognitive abilities that are specialized abilities, modules that are weakly associated with general intelligence.
Right, next up, I've got Brokenomics industrializing space. Yes, this was another standout talent. This was... how did this happen? Oh, I know what it was. So me and Bo were arguing on the pod, because Bo likes to do space segments every now and again. And he did one about living on Mars. And my view is that we should colonize everywhere in the solar system apart from Mars. I don't like Mars. And I then put up the case for why Venus is better. And for those of you who know a little bit about space, you might be thinking, no, that's wrong. Venus is awful. No, I'm right. Venus is better. And I explained it in that episode. And anyway, so there was a planetary scientist who was watching that, who got in touch. How did he get in touch? Maybe a comment, maybe an email, can't remember now. But he got in touch to say, oh yeah, I'm a planetary scientist and I agree with you. And he made some other good points. So I thought, oh, he sounds like an interesting person to talk to. So I got in touch, connected up on one of the messaging app, whatever one it was. And I was speaking to this guy and quickly realized, yeah, okay, he's got talent for this. Let's get him on. So I did an episode with him. And again, because I was trying to shoehorn it into the Brokenomics frame, I thought, let's make it about industrializing space. And it just happened to work brilliantly. And it was such a far-sighted episode. I mean, we literally go from low Earth orbit industrialization up to the colonization of the local cluster. So, I mean, it just superb. Anyway, the audience loved this one. And I've had him back a couple more times, and we'll definitely have him back again. So, watch the clip. And if you haven't for some reason seen it, go and watch the whole thing. And I'm delighted to say that I have found just the man. Grant Donoghue, planetary scientist. Welcome to Brokenomics.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Good. Well, can you tell us about yourself? I mean, what is a planetary scientist?
So planetary science is a subfield of geology, which is an annoying term because geology specifically refers to the Earth. But I was trained as a sedimentary petrologist. Professionally, I've worked as both a petroleum and a environmental geologist. But more broadly, it means that I study the evolution of systems as... the evolution of systems. We don't tend to say geology in isolation because we've discovered that there's an enormous amount of interaction between the lithosphere, the hydrosphere, and the atmosphere, that considering one without the others is simply not reasonable, both on Earth and on other heavenly bodies.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so you do Earth-based geology as well. I mean, that is probably helpful, because one of the things I was thinking leading into this is, well, how do planetary scientists get jobs? Because... you know, there can't be that much demand for it, given that we're not actually in space yet. But if you can do the geology bit as well, I guess you'll be going to be okay.
Yes. So there are a number of PhD programs, positions in academia, NASA, for example, who are looking into ISRU, a word I'm going to use a lot, in situ resource utilization, for whom planetary scientists are of great interest. But that would be for someone who's more specifically focused on that. I'm a mere mortal, and the allure of the petrochemical industry and the greater opportunities there.
They pay well. Yes, got it. Right. Yes. But nevertheless, we can dream that, you know, 20 years down the line, there'll be real demand for the planetary side of your skill set.
Yes.
Getting to that point, where do you think we're kind of going to go first in terms of making use of space industry? Because I know there is... I mean, there's obviously quite a bit of space industry at the moment with the satellite systems that we have going around. And I understand things are getting pushed in that direction more and more. So, for example, because there's so much data basically up there in the lower Earth orbit, firms are starting to realize that actually it's cheaper to send data centers up into Earth orbit.
and process the data there than it is to sort of bounce it all backwards and forwards all day. And once you start, you know, once you start pushing more and more the value chain up into orbit, well, then you've got a growing industry, and then it's natural at some point to go beyond that. So what do you think are the sort of the key drivers that are going to take us to make this a proper industry?
Well, so studying, there's a wonderful expression in geology, which was by Charles Lyon, who's along with Hutton considered the father of geologists. He said, the present is the key to the past. And so what I think a principle we can extrapolate from that is that if we want to look at how we might expect the industrialization to play out of space, it might be useful to examine how industrialization played out or did not play out in the past. And so in that regard, I would say that where we are in space right now is similar to where the Romans were with the areopile, you know, the little thing that spun around, in that the engineering and the technology is there, but because of a lack of resources or contravening economic motives, you know, for the Romans, it was the fact that they had no real call for labor-saving devices. Labor was the one thing they had no shortage of. That did much to halt the advancement of that technology. There was no virtuous cycle that led to reinvestment and reinvestment and reinvestment. But by contrast, when industrialization did kick off in the United Kingdom and the Low Countries and eventually the rest of Europe, there were a series of factors that drove it, most principally when it comes to geology, coal. England and Wales have the most bountiful resources of anthracite in the world, more or less. High quality coal that burns incredibly cleanly. And it runs right to the surface. And so we've been extracting coal since the 16th century. Railways actually predate the steam engine by 200 years. And a lot of people made a lot of money mining coal around southern England. But one of the interesting things that affected that was that in Roman Britain, the main thing that limited mining was that you wouldn't exhaust the material seams, you'd reach the water table. And unlike many other applications where alternative forms of power like wind or water were appropriate, if you want to pump water out of a mine, you can't then stop those pumps. If the water gets back in, you rot the supports and the whole thing falls in. It becomes unsafe. And so you need a form of power that is portable. You don't need to be attached to a river, and it needs to run constantly. It can't be periodic.
Right. Next up, Brokenomics Energy. Nearly 5,000 views on this one. It really should go easily over 5,000. I think people just thought, oh, it's about steam engines and stuff, and didn't properly apply themselves to it. It was actually a bloody brilliant episode. It was with with Alex Masters, he was the guy that I had on, you know, the election stream where I turned up to do the green screen in a green shirt without really thinking about it and accidentally discovered the most amazing thing ever. Well, he was my co-pilot on that, on the green screen stuff. He wasn't wearing a green shirt because he thought about it a bit more. And anyway, so I had him in for Brokenomics, and we talked through how Britain got industrialized in the first place. And honestly, it's you might think, oh, it's history. How interesting. It is fascinating. It is fascinating. And what... it's difficult to explain. I tell you what, I'll just play the bloody clip and then you can see why it's so fascinating. But again, it was one of those conversations that just rewrote my mental model of the past and how we got here and why England industrialised and how it all fits together. And it was just, for me, this is probably one of my very most favourite episodes because it was so, you know, the wiring changed. Anyway, check it out. Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I thought I'd get into that whole net zero business, and I thought the right person to do that with would be Alex Masters. Alex.
Hello, good afternoon, yes.
Welcome to Brokenomics. Now, we may know you as that steam guy from Twitter and various other places. Tell us about yourself.
Yes, well, it does turn out I'm actually a real person. Yes, so I'm Alex, that steam guy. I'm the chairman of an industrial history charity down in Devon called the Robey Trust.
Mm-hmm.
I potter about making sustainable fuels as part of that, and generally just sort of making myself a nuisance in the community, driving rollers about. But what I really am at heart is a sort of a practical industrial historian, sort of growing up on episodes of Fred Dibner and things like that. Yeah. You know, so really trying to live that up.
And the sort of best of British when we were doing steam
when
things.
When we were doing stuff. England was fascinating because we're at this weird, like Goldilocks country where everything is a bit of a pain, but it's not insurmountable. Right. And because England was quite densely populated, basically all the forests had been chopped down for charcoal making by about the Norman conquest. There's no virgin woodland in England at all by the Tudor period. And it's one of the things the Tudors have real, real problems with is securing charcoal, is sources of charcoal. What we then did, because that becomes a pain, is Abraham Darby in 1709... realizes that you can smelt iron with coke, and all coke is coal that's been, it's gone through the charcoal process, so you've expelled all the volatiles and the sulfur and all the rest of it.
So this is the set it on fire, bury it and then dig it up later.
Yes, warm it up.
Yes.
Well, get it nice and hot, and then yeah, coke is a weird, it feels like pumice. It's a very light, quite expansive sort of rock, but you chuck that in with the limestone and the iron ore and you can make
the great, it burns hotter than coal, does it?
Much hotter than coal, and it's the impurities as well. If you start adding things like sulfur to iron, you'll make it very brittle, so it's unusable.
And there's sulfur in coal.
There's a lot of sulfur in coal, which is what it smells of.
So is coke pretty much pure carbon?
It's pretty much pure carbon. Yeah, you've driven off the volatiles, as they say it is. And you're left with a sort of carbon matrix that holds them all in. And that's what...
And when did we figure that out?
1709.
Okay.
So right at the beginning of the 18th century, that's in...
Isn't that just when the whole Industrial Revolution thing started to
This
turn
is
up?
The Industrial Revolution. Because what he does there is you don't have to wait for a tree to grow to chop it down, to turn it into charcoal. What you do is you mine... basically an infinite amount of fuel. You put it in a coking oven.
Got it.
You can have as much as you want whenever you want, and you can make, and so what happens there is he's now got a competitive advantage over everybody else.
Okay, last episode for this little roundup, and then you can get back to your whatever it is you're doing. This probably goes out slightly after Christmas, so you're just kind of floating around waiting to go back to work, having to find reasons to talk to your in-laws, stuff like that. Anyway, so last one before you can get back to all that. Brokenomics house prices. Now, I'm definitely breaking the rule of favourite episodes of 2025 here, because this is from 2023. It was actually one of the earliest episodes that I did. And it was with a guy, Peter Laurie, who is a very knowledgeable man in finance, who reached out very early on in my Brokenomics journey and said, "Oh, love the stuff you're doing." And we ended up having a couple of chats, and it was really solid. But he's also got a housing company, and him and his partner came on and they talked about the realities of trying to build houses in this country. Because for most of you, I would imagine house prices are a bit bloody annoying, that, you know, they're high, they're really high, they keep going up, and they're expanding faster than your wages. So it's tempting to take a shot at housing developers, is like, why are you making it so sodding expensive? When they explain the steps that they are forced to go through in order to build a bloody house, you could easily understand why houses are so sodding expensive. And again, it was one of those episodes that is necessary to watch to understand why we're in such a systematic bloody mess in this country. I mean, there's one bit, I don't know if it's in the clip, because Thomas basically did all of this for me. But there was one bit they were explaining. Before they can build a house, they need to send people down there at night to stand in the plot with a ticker tracker thing and count how many bats fly overhead. And that is just one of hundreds of bits of bullshit that they need to comply with before they can build a bloody house. So, if you think... it's one of those things. Whenever you think Britain is screwed up, when you really drill into the detail and speak to people who know stuff, you realise it is considerably more screwed up than you thought it was. Anyway, here's a clip.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, we're going to be answering the question as to why house prices are so high. And to address this question, I've got back Peter Laurie,
Dan,
friend of the show. Good to have you back. Thanks so much to seeing you again. But also Ian Lush. Thank you very much for coming on, Ian. Now, you flagged this on a previous Brokenomics that you've got a sort of a thing into a property developers.
Yeah, there's three of us run a small niche house builder, if you like. I suspect housing supply is going to drop because of some of the factors we talk about here. And this is why I said to you when we started, I want to talk about the banking industry as well. I think we're never going to get to the 300,000. And actually, it's entirely possible that this year we don't produce the same, we'll be lower than we produced last year.
Because every data point you've given me so far shows that supply just goes down and demand just goes up.
Yeah.
So the lines are heading away from each other quite fast.
And we've seen, what really worries me is every recession you have, you see a drop in the number of house builders.
That's also been clear from this.
I mean, it's clear to me we're in recession now.
Yes. So, Ian, he just painted a fairly pessimistic picture from supply and demand. Help us get into the nitty and gritty. Give us a basic overview of the process of actually building a house.
Okay. So you start by trying to identify a possible site that you could develop, which in our experience is mostly brownfield. So existing urban land, if you like. So having identified something that you think might be suitable for development, you've then got to negotiate with the owner in order to strike a deal to be able to buy that. And that's after you've checked that it's within the urban boundary, therefore it's likely to be developable. If it's outside the urban boundary, there's every chance that you wouldn't be able to develop it in the first place. So you've gone through a bit of thinking and a bit of process and some negotiation. And
you've had to do search to make sure there's not pipes or electric cables.
A whole raft of research to make sure that lots of different factors aren't going to be an immovable problem.
Okay. And one of the biggest
They can fall into lots of different categories, from ecology to categorization of land, to where it is, to drainage, a whole raft of things that could be an absolute brick wall that stops you ever developing it.
And this, something I'd throw in here as well, sorry to interrupt.
No, go for it.
There's still a certain amount of EU legislation which makes a lot of developable land undevelopable. I'm referring to SSSI here.
Yeah.
If you are within a certain distance of I'm going to get it wrong now.
Site of special scientific interest.
You can't develop.
So if you're within 400 metres of the boundary of a SSSI categorised piece of land, you can't build. You won't get residential permission.
How often does that come up?
Because it's all over the country.
You go off and have a look, presumably, at possible housing sites all the time.
One of the first things we check is how close is it to the nearest SSSI?
Oh, so they're all over the place?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they're lots of different sizes as well, because the definition is all about how valuable is the site scientifically.
So how often do you... I'm trying to think through the ratio of how often somebody gets in touch and say, I've got a bit of land I might be interested in selling, to you actually making an offer.
You could, for example, send out 200 letters across an area, a county, and you might get two or three replies. If you're lucky, you might get one piece of land that becomes a deal. But that might take a year to get there.
Okay. Well, with the process you've described, it sounds like it would take at least a year.
Well, in terms of negotiating and figuring out whether it's developable.
Right. Well, hope you enjoyed all of those. If you haven't seen all of those episodes, then go and watch them, because they're really good. In fact, while you're off, until you get back to work, just rewatch the entire back catalogue of Brokenomics. That's probably the best thing you can do. And also, as I mentioned earlier, if you are not subscribed, it is literally only £5 a month. There is no conceivable way that you will miss that amount of money every month. But if you do it, then we can pay editors and then we can do better work. And, you know, maybe at some point we can hire more presenters and do other stuff as well. But only if you support us. So get in the Christmas spirit and subscribe to not just Brokenomics. You get all of it. You get the Chronicles from Luca. You get Real Politiques from Faraz, you get the history stuff from Bo. You get the deep dive analysis that me and Carl often do. And you get to watch the podcast live and leave comments, send in videos if you pay a bit more. There is so much high quality content. And if you're so busy you can't watch any of it, just subscribe and give us the £5 a month anyway as support, because we cannot do this without you. You are the partner that makes all of this possible. Otherwise, you're just going to get BBC'd forever. You know, you're going to get that liberal propaganda. So thank you very much for your support. Thank you for your Christmas spirit. I can see you now. You are reaching into your pocket. You're taking out your wallet. You're removing your credit card. You're going to lotuseaters.com and you're subscribing because you want to make the world a better place. Thank you. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.